But the environment in those days, yeah, it was. I was thinking about this earlier. It was interesting, actually. Funny enough, newspapers were a bit of a microcosm of society, and this place was in those days too. When I first came down to Canberra, the Parliament seemed to be dominated by really, really impressive, strong figures, men of great charisma, and not just Gough. Gough was undoubtedly head and shoulders above all. Oh, Menzies probably more so, although I didn't see Menzies down here. He'd retired before I came here. But they were all sort of big men intellectually, and they were just, that again, charisma is about the only word you can use for them. But there were two, both the Press Gallery and the Parliament, and in the old Daily Telegraph, was sort of two groups. There were these older guys who'd been in World War II and had seen a lot of the world, and then there were a lot of, but were basically either had no formal training or very little formal training, or had done apprenticeships or something like that, maybe a few lawyers, farmers and those sorts of things. Newspapers were pretty much the same. They were most of the journalists I knew were a bit like me, probably most of them from slightly better backgrounds, but very few had any academic training. Most had gone straight into journalism from high school. Some even from intermediate certificate level, because you didn't need to have any university qualifications to become a journalist. It was very much training on the job. And then there were gradually a younger group of people who did have university backgrounds, either degrees or partway through a degree. And I guess society itself was a bit like that. You know, there was this evolution of people who had, if they'd completed high school, they'd had a good education. And then there were the others who were gradually going to university. So that was a bit of a potpourri. The other thing, of course, about Enmore Boys High School was that it was a real potpourri too. Because being post-war, there'd been a lot of migration, refugee migration in many cases. And we had just about every nation, every nationality or ethnicity you can imagine at school. I've got an old photograph, and I was going through the names the other day, and it started off with Avatikian and ended up with Zhang. So, and everything in between. I think the early Anglo-Saxon names there were Brown, Stuart, Potts, and I think there was a Jones. And that's out of about 80 or 90 kids. Yeah. One of my best friends was a Chinese kid named Jackson Wong. And there are a number of Chinese, some Poles. Weren't many Italians, funnily enough, although there was quite a lot of Italian and Greek people living in the area. There were a few Irish. But it was quite a mixture of races and ethnic backgrounds and things like that, and everyone got on quite well. There was no sense of them or us. So I mean, the multicultural stuff we have today was alive and living in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, I can relate again as a Brunswick boy. Yeah. You know, same thing. People got on well in the main, and there was no official government policy encouraging it. It's just
happened. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I guess being low income, working class people had big bigger problems to think about.
Yeah, yeah.
Hating each other or having a go at each other.
Yeah, that's right.
Can we talk now about your impressions of Canberra? Because that's where I cut you off a while ago. As a city or as a place, like you've come down from Newtown, Sydney, and I guess you've never been to Canberra before?
No, I've never been here before. I got in my car, packed it with some clothing. I was very fortunate. One of the good things in those days, all the newspapers provided accommodation for their staff. And that was one of the incentives for coming here. There were two groups of people came down here. One were full-time and the other were sessionals who just came down when Parliament was sitting. Excuse me. And they were quartered in places like Ainslie Hotel, the Embassy Hotel, a couple of other places. The others who were here full-time, that was included me, had full-time accommodation. And the Telegraph had a block of flats at Red Hill, on the corner of Knights and Hicks Street, Red Hill. There are eight units there. And mine was a two-bedroom unit, which I got for the princely sum of $7 a week, which in those days was pretty good. But anyway, I packed up my car, waved goodbye to my mum and dad, and drove down here, not knowing where I was going, except to just follow the Hume Highway and keep going. And took 4.5 hours, which was pretty good. Even in those days, 4.5 hours, I mean, it's about 3 hours today on a super-duper highway. This was virtually a tarred goat track. And got to Canberra. And my first impression of Canberra was pretty startling. It was not at all what I expected, because they had all those government flats all down Canberra Avenue. And it looked like some sort of gulag, you know. It was boxy, strange architecture, all the same. Then I got into Civic, and I think that was the only set of traffic lights in Canberra in those days, just between what do they call them, east and west buildings, isn't it?
Yep.
And they were quite grand buildings. I was impressed with those. I then came over the bridge, which had only just been built. In fact, I'm not even sure that the lake was full at that stage. Drove straight to Parliament House and made my way up to the press gallery. So I was not terribly impressed with what I'd seen up to Parliament House, and then one of the staff took me out to the flat, and that was quite different. I thought it was nice and leafy, and the houses all looked fairly... well, they looked much, much better than the sort of housing that I was accustomed to in Newtown. The flat was a palace compared with the house I'd lived in. It had hot and cold running water. There was none of this old Kero heater. It was nicely furnished. So I thought that was all pretty good. There were nice rental shops just around the corner. Went round to the supermarket to get something to eat and discovered that they sold grog in the supermarket, which you didn't do in Sydney. So I grabbed myself a bottle of red wine, and I think they had a butchery there. So I set myself up that night and cooked my first meal I'd cooked for myself in my life. I was engaged at that stage. I'd met my fiancée in Kay Kersop's shorthand class. In fact, I think I spent more time, I was more interested in going to shorthand class to see her than I was to learn shorthand. But if I hadn't done well in shorthand, I would have been kicked out of the class and wouldn't have seen us. So it was sort of a chicken and egg situation. And so I figured that this place would be pretty good to bring it down to. And that's Pamela, that's my wife's name. I commuted back and forth every weekend if I could, sometimes every second week, and for 6 or 7 months until we got married.
Okay.
And then she came down. But yeah, the impressions of the place, they were, I thought Canberra was a much more attractive place than Sydney, without any doubt. I mean, it was cleaner, it was smaller, and because it was smaller they were able, and of course it was run by the National Capital Development Commission, so there was none of this nonsense about getting the ratepayers to pay for cleaning things up or anything like that. It was a case of just anything that was necessary you paid for. They say, I don't know whether it's true or not, but it was said that Sir John Overall, who was the head of the NCDC, would go up to the top of Red Hill each week with his staff, and he'd look over all of Canberra to make sure that everything was in its right place, that all the roofs were the right colour, and that was the main thing. I mean, they were very, very protectionist about those sorts of things, that all the buildings had to look right. And presumably they had to look right from a great height. So I suppose it did seem a little bit clinical. And the roundabouts was a bit of a trick at first, but once I got used to them, they were fine. And the roads were terrific. By comparison with Sydney, there was hardly any traffic. On nights when Parliament was sitting, after Parliament had finished sitting, we'd all jump into our cars after the non-members bar had closed and race one another across Kings Avenue Bridge and then down along whatever is the road that runs along the side of the lake, down to the Hotel Ainslie and sit there and have a few grogs. There were no breathalysers in those days, thank God. But that was fun.
What about the social life of Canberra back then? What was there? What was available?
If you worked in Parliament House, you didn't have much of a social life, to be quite honest, because when Parliament was sitting, you were working pretty much all day, every day. Or from early morning till fairly late at night. And so working every night anyway, so it was pretty hard to have a social life other than after work. The non-members bar was probably the main centre of social activity. Or the Hotel Wellington. The non-members bar closed at 4:30 if Parliament wasn't sitting, and half an hour after the last house rose if Parliament was sitting. So basically social life was either dinner parties Friday night at the Willow, or you wouldn't go to the Hotel Canberra bar, which is the back of the old Hotel Canberra near where the lake is. That was a blood house, so that was where all the tradies went, and you didn't go in there unless you wanted to fight. The Hotel Civic, which doesn't exist anymore, I don't think. It's now a block of flats. The Hotel Civic was the same. The Hotel Wellington Saloon Bar, was it Saloon Bar? Lounge Bar. It was okay. It was that was where the public servants and the journos and so on went and drank. Or otherwise it was either dinner parties or party parties in people's houses. There were virtually no restaurants. There were cafes. Lobby Restaurant hadn't been built when I first came down here. I remember in Parliament House itself, there was the non-members' dining room. And that was like something out of what I imagined a school boarding house dining room would be like, or a railway refreshment room. It had all these round tables with white tablecloths and old silver tea pots and coffee pots. Very, very conservative crockery and cutlery. And there were all these what seemed to be old ladies in white uniforms who'd with big bosoms who'd bustle around and take your order and disappear into the background where the kitchen was. You couldn't see the kitchen in the old non-members dining room. And then come back out again. So it was a very, very sort of conservative style of place. That changed a few years later when they got rid of that room and turned it into more of a cafeteria. But there were no restaurants. So basically, if you wanted to have any social life, you did it at home or one of the pubs I mentioned.
Mm-hmm. What was the nature of your work, that first job you had here when you were sent down? What was it, the title of the job, and what were the duties involved?
Well, I was the most junior person in the office. The office comprised Alan Reid, who was the chief political correspondent for the telly. In fact, he was the political correspondent for the telly. And Alan had been here pre-war. And he was about 55, very heavy smoker, had 1.5 lungs removed. So how he survived, that I don't know, but he was still smoking, as we all were. Bob Bordino was the bureau chief. Fred Brenchley, who later became the general manager of Fairfax, and Graham Howard, who died. So there were four or five reporters and a photographer. I called Peter Hardacre, who's also did. I was the most junior in the office. In those days, because it was Vietnam, the big jobs were foreign affairs and defence. That was the senior reporters looked after those areas. And I, being a new boy, was given the least glamorous jobs, which were health and social welfare. So I took an interest in health and became quite interested in health policy. The other thing we did in those days, the gallery was far more competitive than it was today, particularly in terms of reporting Parliament. Up until a few years earlier, each newspaper had its own gallery reporting team. By the time I came down here, the Fairfaxes, Syme and Consolidated Press had established Australian Associated Press, but they also decided that they would have an Australian Associated Press gallery reporting service for the three papers, so basically the start of the economy drives. So we had AAP, to which were seconded the junior guys from the Telegraph, Sydney Morning Herald, Age, and the West Australian. So there were about four or five of us working there. So the gallery was being reported by AAP, the Herald and Weekly Times, News Limited, the ABC, Australian United Press, which was all the country newspapers, had their own agency, and probably one or two other groups, plus freelancers who might or might not take an interest in what was going on in Parliament. Because a lot more of the Parliament House reporting was actually about legislation in Parliament, which rarely is reported today. So I was seconded to the AAP team for whenever Parliament was sitting. So my job was, when Parliament was sitting, We'd all assemble in the AAP room, go to the house, do question time, come out, and because there were so many different groups reporting Parliament, there was a real competition to get your story on the wire before anybody else, and better than anybody else. So we'd sort of have maybe shifts of about 5 to 10 minutes during question time, and then, or if a question came up that was particularly significant, you'd just tap the guy and they were sitting next to you on the shoulder, which meant I'm leaving, you take over, and he'd run out, the AAP room was just at the back of the gallery, so you'd run to that, type out your story, hand it to the bureau, the service chief, who was a bloke called Tom McNeil, and Tom had sub-edited it, handed it to a woman or a man, usually a woman, who was a teleprinter operator.
Teleprinter,
yeah. And that was a direct line to the AAP office in Sydney, and I just sent it away and then be filed back out to all the newspapers. So as I said, it was an extremely competitive environment, and there was, in those days, there were more people in the press gallery than there were in the Parliament,
yeah.
You know, particularly at night, because you could not afford to not have a man in the gallery in case something happened. Things like Gough throwing a glass of water over Paul Hasluck. I mean, if there was no one in the gallery, it would have been unnoticed.
Yeah.
And there was no television or anything like that, so you had to have a physical presence in there. We did have, there were radios, they were not radios, speakers. So you had a speaker in the office which you could turn on and hear what was going on in the house. But that was the only way you could monitor what was going on. So you had to physically be there.
What was the wage like? I know I'm stretching your memory a bit.
Was it
a reasonable income with possibilities of promotion?
I came down here, I was a C grade. In those days you had a 4-year cadetship, which could be compressed, and I did mine in 2. And then you had 5 grades of classification, which had a different pay rate. So it went D was the lowest, C, B, A plus. And I think by the time I came down here, I was probably a C or a B. And that was not bad pay. It wasn't great. I was broke when I first came down, but that was my own silly fault. We were paying $7 a week for the flat, and I think I was probably on something like 50 or 60.
Mm-hmm.
No way in the world we could have afforded to pay the full price, the real price for accommodation. So the subsidised rental was probably one of the real attractions of coming to Canberra. Not just for me, but for a lot of other journos.
Yes.
I can't remember. It might have been a bit more than 50, might have been about 75, 80. But in those days it was not bad. Reasonable enough to be able to, well, again, we could afford to feed ourselves, run 2 cars.
And it sounds like early on you had decided to stay here, like that you made a commitment to the place, bringing your fiancée.
Yes, when she came down, we were expecting to stay here I'd pretty well decided that I wanted to stay here for a fairly long time. I liked the work. I liked the town. Even though there wasn't lots to do, I guess the social life, as much as anything else, was taking advantage of the bush and the parkland and things like that. So you'd go out to barbecues at the Cotter, and or Canberra Pool as it then was, the only thing I really missed was the beach. That was a little bit too far away to go down regularly.
Did your wife have a job here in Canberra?
Yes, she'd worked in the Telegraph with me, as I said. When she came down here, she got a job. She was looking around for anything, and she got a job with a doctor, as a doctor's practice manager, and she was only there until she found something else, and she was only there for a couple of weeks when one of the doctors in the practice called her in and said, you are pregnant, are you? And she said, I don't think so. And he said, I want to make quite sure of that, because there's just been a kid in here with German measles, and if you're pregnant, we'd better take precautions. So as it turned out, she was, and so she got zapped with something or other, and that turned out okay, and then she ceased work and just became a full-time mother, housekeeper or housewife, and she ended up, after a few years, we had another child. She had a lot of difficulty with the first birth, a lot of difficulty. So it was 5 years before we had the second baby. And she then went and joined a craft group that set up a store out at, on the road, yes. Should have known.
Hall?
It was near Hall, yeah.
Murrum Bateman.
It was between Hall and Murrum Bateman. It was it was an old, the old schoolhouse at Ginninderra Schoolhouse. They established Ginninderra Schoolhouse, which became a very, very popular outlet for local crafts and arts and crafts. Including, they started off, can't think of the woman's name, but a woman who knitted and became quite a fashion icon a few years later, but she got a start at Ginninderra, and they expanded that into another gallery nearby, and then the person who owned the land sold it to somebody else, and this guy wanted to take it over himself, so they ended up closing it down, which was a shame. But and by that time I was fortunate, I was making enough money that she didn't have to go back to work. Yeah. So
can you tell me describe a typical daily routine in that early period that you were here? What time would you get here? Did you need a pass to come in? That kind of thing, the very beginning of arriving at the building.
Well, fortunately, you could, in those days, you could just park out the front, which was very convenient, or at the side, or if the worst came to the worst, if it was really bad, you'd go and park at Campbell up the back. It depended whether Parliament was sitting or not, but generally, the Telegraph being a morning newspaper, you'd start at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and work through till, usually till about, what would happen actually is you'd come in at about 1 o'clock and get lunch in the non-members dining room with the other people from the office. Go back to the office about 2 o'clock and then start deciding what sorts of things you were going to do, which was usually ringing relevant contacts in the round that you had. Everything was divided up into these rounds, and as I said, the senior guys did the foreign affairs, defence, and there are lots of stories about foreign affairs and defence, F-111 purchases, Vietnam War, all sorts of other things like that. So the bureau chief would talk to the Sydney office, they'd get an idea of what stories we might be thinking of doing here, what was happening in Canberra. By the time we got into the office, there was a set of pigeonholes in the gallery, in the middle of the press gallery, just on the side of the doors to the House of Reps. And by the time we'd get into the gallery, each newspaper had its own pigeonhole, and our pigeonhole would have been filled with press releases, up maybe 1-2 inches worth of paper, and press releases, reports, all sorts of junk. So that would give you the basis of the sorts of things that you knew were going on. The bureau chief had talked to Sydney about that. The Sydney chief of staff would suggest any particular stories that they might want followed up, or any comments that they might want checked out or sort. And that would then be assigned around the different people in the office, or you'd either volunteer that you were going to do something, or you'd be told that you could go and here's a handout, follow this up, get some more details of that. In most cases, we used the handouts as a guide to start asking questions rather than just regurgitate the press release. And so we'd sort of try and pad them out. And we'd try to have our stories written by about 5. They would all go through the bureau chief to just make sure that it was that there was a second look at it. And again, newspapers in those days were totally different from today, because you could not send a story from here to publication without it being vetted by at least 5 or 7 different people who'd check it on the way. If I wrote a story here, it'd be checked by the bureau chief, it'd then be sent to Sydney, where it'd be looked at by the news editor, then be sub-edited, then go down to be set in type, and would then go to the proofreader's room, who would read, check the copy against the original version to make sure that it was accurate and everything like that.
Were there other checkings?
That was basically, of course, a composite or a linotype operator would then set it in hot metal.
Yep.
And of course, there'd be a makeup sub and printer who would put it into the page and run a proof off. So there was a constant checking of a number of times along the way, yes, where people could find out that the name had been misspelt, or the grammar was not right, or all sorts of things. Whereas today, of course, most people sub their own copy, and that's why a lot of the time you find that there are many mistakes in the newspaper, either spelling or grammar or both. So we had our own. When I first came down, we had a teleprint, or telex. Teleprinter, which was a direct dedicated line between our office and Sydney, and it was open all the time, so anything that was sent would just go straight through to Sydney. But we didn't have a teleprinter operator in those days. We had a the post office was over in West Wing, and the at the back of West what was West Wing, and telegram operators who worked there would come over to Parliament House and earn a bit more dough by working in the gallery for the various papers from about 5 o'clock on. So our teleprinter operator would come in from the post office. By that time the copy would have been filled up, and he'd just start repunching it into the teleprinter and then send it off to Sydney. After a while, it was decided that we'd have we'd swap the teleprinter for a telex, and we then got our own full-time telex operator in, who'd, and that instead of just typing the or retyping the copy directly onto a teleprint, she would cut tape and then feed the tape into the telex, which meant that you only had to pay for the line while it was actually being used. Okay. So it was a way of just a little bit more efficient and a little bit of cost saving. And then we'd listen to the 6 o'clock news on the ABC to find out whether there was anything happening that we didn't know about. And then go to dinner between 6 and 8. One person would stay in the office between 6 and 8 and you'd take it in turns. And in those days, we went home. You'd go home for dinner. I could get home from here in 10 minutes and be back in the office in 10 minutes. So you got about an hour and a half to eat. And then stay on until 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, when you'd ring the Sydney office and ask if you could leave. And they'd either ask you to hang around if there was something happening, or if you knew something was likely to happen, of course you'd stay until it finished. Because in those days, the final deadline for the Daily Telegraph was about 3 a.m. in the morning. So if something was happening, you could still make the paper, the final edition of the paper, up until about 2:30 to 3. By 3 o'clock, it was very